Thanks, Nona, and thanks, Ross. I really feel like we could all just go home right now because we've worshipped, we've sung the story. I feel a bit redundant, but anyone here, so we'll progress. When I was asked to do this, I was asked to do the service on the 24th. I didn't know it was Palm Sunday, neither, I don't think, Pete, you'd remember it either. And interestingly enough, as things happen, I was thinking about this passage about the sign of Jonah. And it seems to me that it's a very appropriate passage to have on Palm Sunday, because it is Jesus giving an indication that people aren't quite seeing what's happening. It's often struck me that the cloak that I throw down on the pathway for the donkey on Palm Sunday is the same cloak I hide behind in fear. They say that a week is a long time in politics. Well, that's not my notes. I think what would be useful is to start with a prayer. Let's pray. Jesus Christ, of undefeated gentleness, you seek us out. You go to that part of us that we've given up for dead, declaring us alive. With disturbing simplicity, you set your eyes upon us, astonishing us with your compassion, undoing us with your infinite tenderness, reaching us with your love. In quietness, may we accept you, and may our way of seeing one another be illuminated by your reconciling love with us, that accepts us before we ask. So, look, the way I'll try and do this is to tell you a couple of stories of mine, because really I can only speak from my experience. So this is an invitation to look at life through my windscreen for a while. And then I'll try and look at life through the windscreen of Jonah and invite you to join me in that as well. And then I'm going to finish by asking someone in the congregation to invite us to look through her window. So, two stories, and I'll try and keep it fairly quick. One was from back when I was a young fellow travelling around Europe with my then-girlfriend, soon-to-be wife, Malin. And we were having a wonderful time in the Greek islands. We learnt to do the island hopping from my sister, who was living in Athens at the time. And the way you did it was get on the ferry. When you get off the ferry at the port of the island, you walk past all those people who are touting for business for their little hotels or guest houses or whatever, because you want to be in charge of the situation. And you go into the local taverna or whatever and sit down, have a beer or a coffee or whatever you feel like, and just think about where you'd like to stay on the island. You look around and think, ooh, it'd be nice to stay up there on the top of the hill looking out over the water. So when you've decided, you walk up the hill and you find a sign. Somewhere there'll be a sign in a window saying room to let. Served us well. We were spending an average of between $8 and $9 a night this way for a room for two people. And that was a great way of going around. And then we went to Crete. And what I didn't realise about Crete is the main city in Crete is Heraklion. And it's not a little fishing village like on the other islands. It's actually a very big, bustling city. But as Malin might inform you, I can be a little bit pig-headed sometimes. And when we got off the ship at Crete, at Heraklion, it was already dinner time, really. The sun had gone down. And the people were touting for business on the port, but I knew better. And we went looking for somewhere to stay, and it was already kind of dark. And we found that the hotels were kind of four times the... And I refused to pay $38 for a hotel room. So anyway, the long and the short was, found a little tourist agency. They found us a room at a, where people, rent out a room. that we settled on because it was getting late, and they gave us a little brochure that had the little map on it, and off we went and got lost, totally lost. Just the map. We went, asked people, people would shake their heads. Some people would say, oh yeah, and they point you away. Bear in mind that a Greek city has roads that are actually just alleyways, covered alleyways sometimes. So anyway, we got lost and it got real late. It got later and later actually, and it got to the point where all the lights were being switched off on the streets. All the people who had been out for dinner had gone home, and it started to feel a bit creepy. The only people left on the streets were people that didn't feel like I wanted to spend the night, you know, in their presence. So I felt a bit kind of silly and a bit desperate, and I just kind of silently said, can you get me out of this one? And the little voice inside me said, go to the corner and turn right. There will be somewhere. There will be a light. So went to the corner, turned right, and sure enough, there was a light up halfway up the street. So I thought, okay. And went up and we knocked on the door of the place, and someone quite startled answered that door. They'd just been closing up. It was actually a business. And they'd obviously stayed back to do some work. And I explained the predicament to them, and they motioned me to come over to a table. And the table had a glass top. They reached down the side of the table and flicked a switch, and two fluoro tubes went boom, 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 and came up underneath the printer's film of the map of the city, which was laid out on the table because he'd been printing it that day. And he looked at the thing that I had, looked at it on the map, on the big scale map, looked back and drew himself through. The thing wasn't right that I had anyway. He motioned us, took us out and walked the streets, found the place, knocked on the door. The people were very angry because I think it was probably about 11:30 at night by now. And he settled them down, let us into the room. I tried to give him some money. He refused. And we departed with the door closing and us having a safe bed for the night. It's a great story, isn't it? Lovely story. Second story is... we're now married, it's about 6 years later. We've lived in Karratha for a while, where Malin's had some health problems, including being airlifted by the RFDS out of Karratha one night when I was in Broome. And we want to have a child and we can't. It's just not happening. And we're doing everything. Believe me, we're doing everything to try and have a baby, and it's just not happening. And at that time, it's really hard for us because our friends are having babies. Think of the people who are a little bit older than James by about 2 years. People are having babies and they're bringing them to church, and the church is saying, ah, this baby, it's a sign of God's blessing. So we don't have a sign of God's blessing. We have a lack of a sign of God's blessing. So what do we do with that? Does that mean we're not blessed, therefore we're damned? What's that mean? My sense is that when we think about signs of God's blessing, we're usually thinking about things that we want, that make us feel happy. To be honest, I find it hard to sit with prayer sometimes when I hear, and it's just me, I know, so I'm not pronouncing judgment on anybody, but when I hear a prayer that says, thank you, God, because the little child that we prayed for who'd had the bad accident has now recovered and is well and is going to have a healthy and happy life, I just feel like taking that person by the hand and leading them through oncology and PMH and being a fly on the wall for the parents who are sitting next to their baby who is dying and will die. And they're prayers for a miracle will not be answered the way they want them to. They will not get the sign of God's blessing that they're looking for. Or if I hear us thanking God that we live in a free country, I feel like going, shall I go to a country where people are oppressed and just explain to them that God has signed me to live in a place of freedom? If I'm thanking God for it, God must have done it. Maybe I'm just being thankful in general. But it worries me. When I thank God that I live in a wealthy country, what am I saying about the way God has blessed those who don't live in a wealthy country? If God's blessing is the stuff that is of my desire, then I'm probably going to be in a difficult place more than once in my life. I think the Pharisees are a little bit like me, really. They had a good evidence-based practice. Now, we all kind of believe in evidence-based practice, don't we? If you want to believe in something, you better see the evidence. And it seems to me that I can easily fall into a life of Christianity in which I give God the opportunity to justify my faith in him by giving me good evidence to do so. And life can become a series of that. A series of episodes by which I grant God the right to present enough solid evidence for me to have faith. Man, how absurd is that? Sorry, you're all getting a bit glum. I'm just looking at the absurdity of it, to be honest. I probably should refer to my notes at some stage. Yeah, if they want to, just tell me whatever it is they're feeling. It seems to me that it's possible for us to turn the most sublime of relationships, that of human with God, into a situation where God is a functionary of our desires, and that we know that God's good when our desires are met. I know now that in the times of trial, what wasn't missing was God's presence. I now know that what was missing was my capacity to perceive it. And it seems to me that that doesn't make me a bad person, it just makes me a human being. And it seems to me that maybe people in Jesus' day were not all that different from me. Jesus had been in the presence of people. He'd performed miracles. He'd healed people. And then he'd argued with the Pharisees, and so as a way of giving him a chance to justify himself, he was asked to perform a sign. I reckon the Pharisee probably thought he was doing Jesus a favour. Okay, well, you know, here's your chance. The paradox for me is that when we demand our relationship with God is characterised by us getting what we want out of life, our relationship suffers. When we realise that God's intention is to use us, that can be offensive. We're getting used. Not for us to use God. And we let go of our needs to apply our conditions, let go of the need for a feel-good factor, let go of the need for every day to be Palm Sunday. When we abandon those needs, we might find out they're met in ways we can't imagine. Let me turn to the story of Jonah. Because apart from the fact that we know that from the reading that Jesus said, the sign I'll give you is the sign of Jonah, which is a sign that I'm going down for 3 days, not coming up again until that's over. I was interested into just looking a little bit deeper into the story of Jonah, so I did. And it's there in the first sentence, actually. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. I'm always interested in words and where they come from, so I looked up the etymology dictionary. Etymology. Thank you. I looked up the etymology and it was just full of insects, but yeah. So I was interested to find out that Jonah, does anyone, by the way, know what Jonah means? It means dove. Does anyone know what Amittai means? Means truth. And in one version of the dictionary that I looked at, it's truth in the context of truth which conquers. So let's read it with those words translated. The word of the Lord came to the dove, the son of the truth which conquers. Wow, that put it in a different perspective for me. The incredible symbolism of the dove all through the Bible, you know, from the moment that Noah sent the dove out to explore to see if the water had receded. Anyway, said, go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it. So he ran away from the Lord, went to Tarshish. So first, let me tell you about Tarshish, that he went via Joppa. He went down to a place called Joppa. It's now called Jaffa. It's on the coast there. And Joppa means beautiful. And as an aside, the word beautiful was actually invented by William Tyndale when he wrote the English version of the Bible and then got burnt to the stake. Just following up on your thing last week, Pam. Anyway, went down there. Tarshish is disputed. It could be various places, but the place that it's probably most likely is the furthest place he could go in the other direction, which is actually a Phoenician port over in Spain. Very rich, having a resources boom there at the time, actually. And so he went over there. The other thing about Tarshish is ships of Tarshish, it was like a class of ship, you know. So a ship of Tarshish was just the biggest seaworthy vessel that was going in the day. So he got on the biggest seaworthy vessel of the day and took off the opposite direction. And of course, we know how the story goes. Interestingly enough, for me anyway, who did Jonah's story save first? Who first submitted themselves to the Lord as a result of Jonah's actions? Sailors, yeah. So for me, that was an interesting thing, that these guys that were from a totally different culture, they didn't actually want to throw Jonah overboard, but Jonah said, no, I must die that you can live. And so they threw him over, and they were very frightened of what the Lord might do to them. And they immediately made sacrifices to God and prayed to God, which is interesting. So anyway, Jonah went to Nineveh to preach against it. Now Nineveh, as we know, was a big city, and at the time was the most important city in the known world. Why? Because it was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. This story is set, by the way, in about 770 BC. So if we're in Jesus' time, it's as far away from them as, say, the bubonic plague is for us. It's way back there. The various people that I've read, the biblical scholars who write about it, have told us that it was most likely written in the 4th century BC, about that period. And I can, because of the genre, because of the type of language it's used, etc., I won't go into those details. But the interesting thing about Nineveh being the capital of the Assyrian Empire and on the rise is that it wasn't only big, it was an incredibly scary place. So we know it's about 30 miles long by 10 miles wide. It runs along the Tigris River. The fortifications around the city are walls that are over 40 foot high, very, very tall. And it's got an inner fortress inside with walls of similar dimensions. And at the time that Jonah's asked to go there, the Assyrian Empire is raging across half of the known world. I'll just read from one of the historians. I'll just read his words. Judge from the vaunting inscriptions of a king's, no power more useless, more savage, more terrible ever cast its gigantic shadow on the page of history as it passed on the way to ruin. The kings of Assyria tormented a miserable world. They exult to record how space failed for corpses. They flung away the bodies of soldiers like so much clay. They made pyramids of human heads. They burned cities, how they filled populous lands with death and devastation, reddened broad deserts with carnage of warriors and scattered whole countries with the corpses of defenders as with chaff, how they impaled heaps of men on stakes, blah, blah, blah. They cut off the hands of kings and nailed them to the wall. You get the picture. They flayed people and left the skin on, you know, blah, blah, blah. Not a very nice place to be sent. Pretty full on. So the dove gets sent to tell these people that they're doing the wrong thing, they should turn to the Lord. No worries. Bit like telling a young Jewish boy to go to, say, the Gestapo headquarters in Berlin, in the midst of the Second World War and just ask them not to be so nasty anymore. So off he goes. I've kind of skipped past the bit where he's swallowed up by the fish and then spat out in that experience of being resurrected. But off he goes to do this. And Jonah goes there and somehow he gets through those fortifications, which is interesting because the walls were so strong and the doors were so strong actually that when the Babylonians conquered the place, about 160 years later, they couldn't get through. So I'll just tell you a bit about what happened there, just to put it into context for you. And then I need to remember to tell you something. Okay, so what happened about 160 years later is that the Babylonians got together with the Scythians and the Medes, and they formed this alliance, and they went through and decided to break the Assyrian Empire, which they did. Couldn't get through the walls and the doors, so what they did is they surrounded and starved them out. And there was an old oracle who had said that Assyria won't fall until water becomes its enemy. And what happened is huge floods, huge rains came up, undermined some of the wall, about 4 kilometres long. They poured in. The king of Assyria knew it was over, turned his palace into a funeral pyre, put all his precious stuff on it and threw himself and all his palace officials and family and everybody in there. And that was the end. And what the Babylonians did is they reduced the place to nothing. So that 200 years later, nothing existed of Nineveh. In fact, there's another, I won't read it, but there's another recording from a historian that says there was an army of 10,000 men who marched across those mounds 200 years later, didn't realise they were on Nineveh because it had been reduced to nothing. In fact, Nineveh remained a mythological sort of city, if you like, until 1865 when the archaeologists started exploring it. And they found stuff that's that goes with that story, i.e. they found charred, a lot of charring. They found statues that have been split as if by heat, and they found sediment from flood in that area. Anyway, so until 1865, it was wiped off the face of the earth. And so the thing that's interesting for me, and that one of the biblical scholars I heard talking on the ABC radio said, this story is actually a bit of a Shaggy Dog story. In fact, what we probably don't realise is that a lot of these sort of stories would have evoked different sorts of emotional response, including laughter. And the laughter would have been the laughter of irony, i.e. it's a story about how Nineveh was saved, but the people who heard the story knew that Nineveh was actually wiped from the face of the earth. So the Bible isn't short on irony and isn't short on hyperbole either in terms of giving stories that evoke response and are a bit over the top. The other thing is that it's a story of the people of Israel. And again, I'm fascinated with names. Can someone tell me what Israel means? It's an easier question. Remember Jacob had his name changed to Israel after he struggled all night? Yeah, so it's a story of those who wrestle with God, which is a great name for Israel. I think it's great that it's named Israel now, because hell, if anyone struggles with God. Anyway, so going back to the story, Jonah walks into the city, walks through it, says, if you don't stop doing what you're doing, you'll be destroyed. The greatest city in the world, the superpower of the world, with the greatest king in the world, this one sole figure puts it to them that they should stop doing what they're doing. And the king responds by saying, yeah, okay. I can imagine the kids laughing when they hear that, because that's ridiculous. But that's what happens in the story. And the king goes on to put out a decree whereby everybody has to go into a state of mourning, of repentance, including the animals, which I think probably was another thing that would have made the kids laugh a bit. And then poor old Jonah, he's under his tree and it withers up. And rather than being happy about the fact that the people of Nineveh were saved, good old Jonah, he's really, really angry. He says, I know this was going to happen. I knew you were a compassionate God. Didn't I tell you you'd do this? Which is also something I think could only evoke laughter, because in the culture that that story was told, to suggest that someone would talk to God at all was preposterous. You know, you'd still, when you read the Jewish word, that they don't type the full name of Jehovah or God. It's something you don't do. You don't, let alone talking to God. Jonah argues at God and tells God that he's got it wrong. And Jonah's really annoyed because the tree withers. And then God's basically has to tell Jonah, hey, Jonah, it's not about you. If I want to reach my hand out in forgiveness of people that don't know their right hand from their left, that's mine. And the story is not resolved, it's left hanging. And my sense is that it's great that it's left hanging, because that's how it is with me. When God doesn't treat God's relationship with me as a way of me being able to get what I want, but as a way of me being challenged to perceive God's presence even in the dark place. I'll just go back to a spot in Jonah, because actually, interesting thing about Jonah is that there's a psalm in the middle of it in which Jonah is thankful. Do you recall that? When he is in the depths, and when I talk about depths, we're not just talking about ocean as we know, we're talking about this is where the monsters live. The ocean represents chaos. The worldview is that where we live is like inside a snow dome, you know, like that. So instead of the water being in the snow dome, the water's outside. And down there is where all the dead people go. And it's also where the monsters are. And the ocean has been the enemy of God since God put down the firmament to keep it away from us. So going down there is going down to death and chaos. And in this place, not when he's saved from being run through by a spear by the first guard that he comes across, but it's in this place, it's when he is at the point of death, that Jonah is said to call, is to call out and say, in my distress I called to the Lord and he answered me. From deep in the realm of the dead I called for help and you listened to my cry. You hurled me into the depths, into the very heart of the seas, and your currents swirled around me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you. And then at the end, but I, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. I will say salvation comes from the Lord. And that realization that we hear from the point of Jonah's death through to his obstinance, his fickleness, at the point where God has God's way and not Jonah's when he saves the people of Nineveh. For me, that's the bit that that I need to learn over and over and over again, which is that it's that paradox of when I realize that it's not about me, then I open the way for my relationship with God to get closer than it could be if it was about me. I'm going to ask for Chrissy to finish off, and then if there's any discussion, we can have one.